itself. Coyotes howled in the distance, woo, 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 like something that belonged in the soundtrack of an old John Wayne movie. You did enough, Johnny said in a foggy, stuffy voice. Not yet, the cop said, and smiled. But the nose is a start. It actually improves your looks. Not much, but a little. He opened the back door of his cruiser. As he did, Johnny wondered how long this little comedy had taken. He had absolutely no idea, but not one car or truck had passed while it was going on. Not one. Get in, big shot. Where are you taking me? Where do you think I'd take a self-indulgent pinko pothead asshole like you? To the old Calabozo. Now get in the car. Johnny got in the car. And as he did, he touched the right breast pocket of his motorcycle jacket. The cellular phone was in there. 5. He couldn't sit on his bottom. It hurt too much, so he leaned over on his right thigh, one hand cupped loosely over his throbbing nose. It felt like something alive and malevolent, something that was sinking deep, poisonous stingers into his flesh, but for the time being, he was able to ignore it. Let the cellular work, he prayed, speaking to a god he had made fun of for most of his creative life, most recently in a story called Heaven Sent Weather, which had been published in Harper's Magazine to generally favorable comment. Please let the damned phone work, God, and please let Steve have his ears on. Then, realizing all of that was getting the cart quite a bit ahead of the horse, he added a third request. Please give me a chance to use the phone in the first place, okay? As if in answer to this part of his prayer, the big cop passed the driver's door of his cruiser without even looking at it and walked to Johnny's motorcycle. He put Johnny's helmet on his own head, then swung one leg over the seat. He was very tall, so it was actually more of a step than a swing. And a moment later, the Harley's engine exploded into life. The cop stood astride the seat, unbuckled helmet straps hanging, seeming to dwarf the Harley with his own less lovely bulk. He twisted the throttle 4 or 5 times, gunning the motor as if he liked the sound. Then he rocked the Harley upright, kicked back the center stand, and towed the gear shift down into first. Moving cautiously, to start with, reminding Johnny a little of himself when he had taken the bike out of storage and ridden it in traffic for the first time in 3 years, the cop descended the side of the road. He used the handbrake and paddled along with his feet, watching intently for hazards and obstacles. Once he was on the desert floor, he accelerated, changing rapidly up through the gears and weaving around clumps of sagebrush. Run into a gopher hole, you sadistic fuck, Johnny thought, sniffing gingerly through his plugged and throbbing nose. Hit something hard, crash and burn. Don't waste your time on him, he mumbled, and used his thumb to pop the snap over the right breast pocket of his motorcycle jacket. He took out the Motorola cellular phone. The cellulars had been Bill Harris's idea, maybe the only good idea his agent had had in the last 4 years, and flipped it open. He stared down at the display, breath held, now praying for an S and 2 bars. Come on, God, please, he thought. Sweat trickling down his cheeks, blood still leaking out of his swollen, leaning nose. Got to be an S in 2 bars. Anything less and I might as well use this thing for a suppository. The phone beeped. What came up in the window on the left side of the display was an S, which stood for service, and 1 bar. Just 1. No, please, he moaned. Please, don't do this to me. Just 1 more, please. He shook the phone in frustration and saw he had neglected to pull up the antenna. He did, and a 2nd bar appeared above the first. It flickered, went out, then reappeared, still flickery, but there. Yes, Johnny whispered. Yes! He jerked his head up and stared out the window. His sweat-circled eyes peered through a tangle of long gray hair. There was blood in it now, like the eyes of some hunted animal peering out of its hole. The cop had brought the Softail to a stop about 300 yards out in the scree. He stepped off and then stepped away, letting the bike fall over. The engine died. Even in this situation, Johnny felt a twinge of outrage. The Harley had brought him all the way across the country without a single missed stroke of its sweet American engine, and it hurt to see it treated with such absent disdain. "You crazy shit," he whispered. He snuffled back half-congealed blood, spat a jellied wad of it onto the cruiser's paper-littered floor, and looked down at the telephone again. On the row of buttons at the bottom, second from the right, was one which read name/menu. Steve had programmed this function for him just before they had set out. Johnny punched the button, and his agent's first name appeared in the window. Bill. Pushed it again, and Terry appeared. Pushed it again, and Jack appeared. Jack Appleton, his editor at FS&G. Dear God! Why had he put all these people ahead of Steve Ames? Steve was his lifeline. Down on the desert floor, 300 yards away, the insane cop had taken off the helmet and was kicking sand over Johnny's 86 Harley drag. At this distance, he looked like a kid pulling a tantrum. That was fine. If he intended to cover the whole thing, Johnny would have plenty of time to make his call. If the phone cooperated, that was. The Rome light was flashing, and that was a good sign, but the second transmission bar was still flickering. "Come on, come on," Johnny said to the cellular phone in his shaking, blood-grimy hands. "Please, sweetheart, okay? Please." He punched the name/menu button again, and Steve appeared. He dropped his thumb onto the send button and squeezed it. Then he held the phone to his ear, bending over even farther to the right, and peering out of the bottom of the window as he did so. The cop was still kicking sand over the Harley's engine block. The phone began to ring in Johnny's ear, but he knew he wasn't home free yet. He had tapped into the Roamer network, that was all. He was still a step away from Steve Ames. A long step. "Come on, come on, come on!" A drop of sweat ran into his eye. He used a knuckle to wipe it away. The phone stopped ringing. There was a click. "Welcome to the Western Roaming Network," a cheery robot voice said. "Your call is being routed. Thank you for your patience and have a nice day." "Never mind the 70s shit, just hurry the fuck up," Johnny whispered. Silence from the phone. In the desert, the cop stepped back from the bike, looking at it as if trying to decide if he had done enough in the way of camouflage. In the dirty, paper-choked back seat of the cruiser, Johnny Merrinville began to cry. He couldn't help it. In a bizarre way, it was like wetting his pants again, only upside down. "No," he whispered. "No, not yet. You're not done yet. Not with the wind blowing like it is. You better do a little more. Please do a little more." The cop stood there, looking down at the bike, his shadow now seeming to stretch out across half a mile of desert, and Johnny peered at him through the bottom of the window with his clotted hair in his eyes and the phone mashed against his right ear. He let out a long, shaky sigh of relief as the cop stepped forward and began to kick sand again, this time spraying it over the Harley's handlebars. In his ear, the telephone began to ring, and this time the sound was scratchy and distant. If the signal was going through, and the quality of this ring seemed to indicate that it was, another Motorola telephone, this one on the dashboard of a Ryder truck somewhere between 50 and 250 miles east of John Edward Merrinville's current position, was now ringing. Down in the desert, the cop went on kicking and kicking, burying the handlebars of Johnny's scoot. Two rings. Three rings. Four. He had one more, two at the most, before another robot voice came on the line and told him that the customer he was calling was either out of range or had left the vehicle. Johnny, still crying, closed his eyes. In the throbbing, red-tinged darkness behind his lids, he saw the Ryder truck parked in front of a roadside gas station general store just west of the Utah-Nevada state line. Steve was inside, buying a pack of his damned cigars and goofing with the counter girl, while outside, on the Ryder's dashboard, the cellular phone, Steve's half of the comlink Johnny's agent had insisted upon, rang in the empty cab. Five rings. And then, distant, almost lost in static, but sounding like the voice of an angel bent down from heaven all the same, he heard Steve's flat West Texas drawl. Hello? You? Boss? An eastbound semi blew by outside, rocking the cruiser in its backwash. Johnny barely noticed and made no attempt to flag the driver. He probably wouldn't have done, even if his attention hadn't been focused on the telephone and Steve's tenuous voice. The rig was doing 70 at least. What the hell was the driver going to see in the 0.2 seconds it would take him to pass the parked cruiser, especially through the thick dust matted on the windows? He drew in breath through his nose and hawked back blood, ignoring the pain, wanting to clear his voice as much as he could. Steve! Steve, I'm in trouble! I'm in bad trouble! There was a heavy crackle of static in his ear, and he was sure he'd lost Steve, but when it cleared, he heard, Up, boss! Say again! Steve, it's Johnny! Do you hear me? Hear you. What's... Another crackle. It almost completely buried the next word, but Johnny thought it might have been trouble. I hear you. What's the trouble? God, let that not just be wishful thinking. Please, God. The cop had stopped kicking sand again. He stepped away for another critical look at his handiwork, then turned and began to plod back toward the road, head down, hat brim shading his face, hands plunged deep into his pockets. And then, with a sense of mounting horror, Johnny realized he had no idea what to tell Steve. All his attention had been focused on making the call, ramming it through by sheer willpower, if that was what it took. Now what? He had no clear idea of where he was, only that... I'm west of Ely on Highway 50, he said. More sweat ran into his eyes, stinging. I'm not sure how far west. 40 miles at least, probably more. There's an RV pulled off the road a little further up from me. There's a cop. Not a state cop. A townie, I think. But I don't know which town. I didn't see it on the door. I don't even know his name. He was talking faster and faster as the cop got closer and closer. Soon he would be babbling. Take it easy. He's still 100 yards away. You've got plenty of time. For the love of God, just do what comes naturally. Do what they pay you for. What you've been doing all your life. Communicate, for Christ's sake. But he had never had to do it for his life. To make money. To be known in the right circles. To occasionally raise his voice in the roar of the brave old lion. Yes, all those things. But never for his literal life. And if the cop looked up out of his head down plod and saw him, he was crouched down, but the phone's antenna was sticking up. Of course, it had to be sticking up. He took my bike, Steve. He took my bike and drove it out into the desert. He covered it up with sand, but the way the wind's blowing, it's out in the desert, a mile or so east of the RV I told you about, and north of the road. You might see it if the sun's still up. He swallowed. Call the cops, the state cops. Tell them I've been grabbed by a cop who's blonde and huge. I mean, this guy's a fucking giant. Have you got that? Nothing from the phone but windy silence with an occasional burst of static knifing through it. Steve! Steve, are you there? No, he wasn't. There was only one transmission bar showing in the phone's display window now, and no one was there. He had lost the connection, and he'd been concentrating so hard on what he was saying that he had no idea when it had happened, or how much Steve might have heard. "Johnny, are you sure you got through to him at all?" That was Terry's voice, a voice he sometimes loved and sometimes hated. Now he hated it. Hated it worse than any voice he had ever heard in his life, it seemed. Hated it worse for the sympathy he heard in it. "Are you sure you didn't just imagine the whole thing?" "No, he was there. He was there. Son of a bitch was there," Johnny said. He heard the pleading quality in his own voice and hated that, too. "He was, you bitch. For a few seconds, at least." Now the cop was only 50 yards away. Johnny shoved the antenna down with the heel of his left hand, flipped the mouthpiece closed, and tried to drop the phone back into his right pocket. The flap was closed. The phone fell into his lap, then bounced to the floor. He felt around frantically for it, at first finding nothing but crumpled papers, DARE anti-drug handouts for the most part, and hamburger wrappers coated with ancient grease. His fingers closed on something narrow, not what he wanted, but even the brief glance he gave it before tossing it away chilled him. It was a little girl's plastic barrette. "Never mind it. You've got no time to think about what a kid might have been doing in the back of his car. Find your damn phone. He must almost be here." Yes, almost. He could hear the crunch scuffle of the big cop's boots even over the wind, which had now grown strong enough to rock the cruiser on its springs when it gusted. Johnny's hand found a nest of styrofoam coffee cups and, amid them, his phone. He seized it, dropped it in his jacket pocket, and pushed the snap closed. When he sat up again, the cop was coming around the front of the car, bent over at the waist so he could peer through the windshield. His face was more sunburned than ever, almost blistered in places. In fact, his lower lip actually was blistered, Johnny saw, and there was another blistery spot at his right temple. "Good. That doesn't cross my eyes in the slightest." The cop opened the driver's side door, leaned in, and stared through the mesh between the front seat and the back. His nostrils flared as he sniffed. To Johnny, each one of them looked roughly the size of a bowling alley. "Did you puke in the back of my cruiser, Lord Jim? Because if you did, the first thing you're going to get when we hit town is a big old spoon." "No," Johnny said. He could feel fresh blood trickling down his throat, and his voice was fogging up again. "I dry heaved, but I didn't puke." He was actually relieved by what the cop had said. "The first thing you're going to get when we hit town." Indicated that he didn't intend to drag him out of the car, blow his brains out, and bury him next to his scoot. "Unless he's trying to lull me, soothe me down, make it easier for him to do, well, to do whatever." "You scared?" the cop inquired, still leaning in and looking through the mesh. "Tell me the truth, Lord Jimmy, I'll know a lie. Tack!" "Of course I'm scared." "Course" came out gorse, as if he had a bad cold. "Good." He dropped behind the wheel, took off the hat, looked at it. "Doesn't fit," he said. "Folks singing bitch ruined the one that did. Never sang leaving on a fucking jet plane, either." "Too bad," Johnny said, not having the slightest idea what the cop was talking about. "Lips which lie are best kept silent," the cop said, tossing the hat that wasn't his over into the passenger seat. It landed on a tangle of meshy stuff that appeared studded with spikes. The seat, bowed into a tired curve by the cop's weight, settled against Johnny's left knee, squeezing it. "Sit up," Johnny yelled. "You're crushing my leg. Sit up and let me pull it out. Jesus, you're killing me." The cop made no reply, and the pressure on Johnny's already outraged left leg increased. He seized it in both hands and tore it free of the sagging seat back with an indrawn hiss of effort that pulled blood down his throat and started him dry-heaving for real. "Bastard!" Johnny yelled, the word popping out in a red-misted coughing spasm before he could pull it back. The cop seemed not to notice that, either. He sat with his head lowered, and his fingers tapping lightly on the wheel. His breath was wheezing in his throat, and for a moment Johnny wondered if the man was mocking him. He didn't think so. "I hope it's asthma," he thought, "and I hope you choke on it." "Listen," he said, allowing none of that sentiment to enter his voice. "I need something for my nose. It's killing me. Even an aspirin. Do you have an aspirin?" The cop said nothing. Went on tapping the wheel with his head down. That was all. Johnny opened his mouth to say something else, then closed it again. He was in terrible pain, all right. The worst he could remember. Even worse than the gallstone he had passed in 89. But he didn't want to die. And something in the cop's posture, as if he were very far away in his own head, deciding something important, suggested that death might be close. So he kept silent and waited. Time spun out. The shadows of the mountains grew a bit thicker and moved a bit closer, but the coyotes had fallen silent. The cop sat with his head lowered and his fingers tapping the sides of the wheel, seeming to meditate, not looking up when another semi went by headed east and the car passed them going west, swinging out to give the parked police cruiser with the ticking roof flashers a wide berth. Then he picked up something which had been lying beside him on the front seat, an old-fashioned shotgun with a double-trigger setup. The cop looked at it fixedly. "I guess that woman wasn't really a folk singer," he said, "but she tried her best to kill me, no doubt about that, with this." Johnny said nothing, only waited. His heart was beating slowly but very hard in his chest. "You have never written a truly spiritual novel," the cop told him. He spoke slowly, enunciating each word with care. "It is your great unrecognized failing, and it is at the center of your petulant, self-indulgent behavior. You have no interest in your spiritual nature. You mock the God who created you, and by so doing you mortify your own pneuma and glorify the mud which is your sarx. Do you understand me?" Johnny opened his mouth, then closed it again. To speak or not to speak, that was the question. The cop solved the dilemma for him. Without looking up from the wheel, without so much as a glance into the rearview mirror, he placed the double barrels of the shotgun on his right shoulder and pointed them back through the wire mesh. Johnny moved instinctively, sliding to the left, trying to get away from those huge dark holes. And although the cop still did not look up, the muzzles of the gun tracked him as precisely as a radar-controlled servo motor. He might have a mirror in his lap, Johnny thought, and then, but what good would that do? He wouldn't see anything but the roof of the fucking car. What in the hell is going on here? "Answer me," the cop said. His voice was dark and brooding. His head was still bent. The hand not holding the shotgun continued to tap at the wheel, and another gust of wind hammered the cruiser, driving sand and alkali dust against the window in a fine spray. "Answer me now. I won't wait. I don't have to wait. There's always another one coming along. So, do you understand what I just told you?" "Yes," Johnny said in a trembling voice. "Pneuma is the old Gnostic word for spirit. Sarx is the body. You said, correct me if I'm wrong, just not with the shotgun, please don't correct me with the shotgun, that I've ignored my spirit in favor of my body, and you could be right. You could very well be." He moved to the right again. The shotgun muzzles tracked his movements precisely, although he could swear that the springs of the back seat made no sound beneath him, and the cop could not see him unless he was using a television monitor or something. "Don't toady to me," the cop said wearily. "That will only make your fate worse." He licked his lips. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to..." "Sarx is not the body. Soma is the body. Sarx is the flesh of the body, The body is made of flesh, as the Word was reputedly made flesh by the birth of Jesus Christ. But the body is more than the flesh that makes it. The sum is greater than the parts. Is that so hard for an intellectual such as yourself to understand? The shotgun barrel, moving and moving, tracking like an autogyro. I never thought of it that way. Oh, please. Even a spiritual naive like you must understand that a chicken dinner is not a chicken. Pneuma, soma, and s. His voice had thickened, and now he was hitching in breath, trying to talk as a person does only when trying to finish his thought before the sneeze arrives. He abruptly dropped the shotgun onto the seat again, gasped in a deep breath. The abused seat creaked backward, almost pinning Johnny's left knee again, and let fly. What came out of his mouth and nose was not mucus, but blood and red filmy stuff that looked like nylon mesh. This stuff, raw tissue from the big cop's throat and sinuses, hit the windshield, the steering wheel, the dashboard. The smell was awful, the smell of rotted meat. Johnny clapped his hands to his face and screamed. There was no way not to scream. He could feel his eyeballs pulsing in their sockets, could feel adrenaline roar into his system as the shock reaction set in. "Gosh, there's nothing worse than a summer cold, is there?" the cop asked in his dark, musing voice. He cleared his throat and spat a clot the size of a crabapple onto the face of the dashboard. It hung where it was for a moment, then oozed down the front of the police radio like an unspeakable snail, leaving a trail of blood behind. It hung briefly from the bottom of the radio, then dropped to the floor mat with a plop. Johnny closed his eyes behind his hands and moaned. "That was Sark's," the cop said, and started the engine. "You might want to keep it in mind. I'd say for your next book, but I don't think there's going to be a next book. Do you, Mr. Marinville?" Johnny didn't answer, only kept his hands over his face and his eyes closed. It occurred to him that quite possibly none of this was happening, that he was in a nuthouse someplace, having the world's ugliest hallucination. But his better, deeper mind knew that wasn't true, the stench of what the man had sneezed out. "He's dying. He's got to be dying. That's infection and internal bleeding. He's sick. His mental illness is only one symptom of something else, some radiation thing, or maybe rabies, or... The cop hauled the Caprice cruiser around in a U, pointing it east. Johnny kept his hands over his face a little longer, trying to get himself under control, then lowered them and opened his eyes. What he saw out the right-hand window made his jaw drop. Coyotes sat along the roadside at 50-foot intervals like an honor guard, silent, yellow-eyed, tongues lolling. They appeared to be grinning. He turned and looked out the other window, and here were more of them, sitting in the dust, in the blazing sun of late afternoon, watching the police cruiser go by. "Is that a symptom, too?" he asked himself. "What you're seeing out there, is that a symptom, too? If so, how come I can see it?" He looked out the cruiser's back window. The coyotes were peeling away as soon as they passed, he saw, loping off into the desert. "You'll learn, Lord Jim," the cop said, and Johnny turned back toward him. He saw gray eyes staring from the rearview mirror. One was filmed with blood. "Before your time is up, I think you'll understand a great deal more than you do now." Ahead was a sign by the side of the road, an arrow pointing the way toward some little town or other. The cop put on his turn blinker, although there was no one to see it. "I'm taking you to the classroom," the big cop said. "School will be in shortly." He made the right turn, the cruiser lifting onto two wheels and then settling back. It headed south, toward the cracked bulwark of the open-pit mine. and the town huddled at its base. Chapter 4 1 Steve Ames was breaking one of the five commandments, the last one on the list, as a matter of fact. The five commandments had been given to him a month ago, not by God, but by Bill Harris. They had been sitting in Jack Appleton's office. Appleton had been Johnny Merenville's editor for the last 10 years. He was present for the handing down of the commandments, but did not participate in this part of the conversation until near the end, only sat back in his desk chair with his exquisitely manicured fingers spread on the lapels of his suit coat. The great man himself had left 15 minutes before, head up and studly gray hair flying out behind him, saying he had promised to join someone at an art gallery down in Soho. "All these commandments are thou shalt nots, and I don't expect you to have any trouble remembering them," Harris had said. He was a tubby little guy, and there probably wasn't much harm in him, but everything he said came out sounding like the decree of a weak king. "Are you listening?" "Listening," Steve had agreed. "First, thou shalt not drink with him. He's been on the wagon for a while, 5 years, he claims, but he stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's not a good sign. Also, for Johnny, the wagon's always had a non-stick surface, even with AA. But he doesn't like to drink alone, so if he asks you to join him for a few after a hard day on the old Harley, you say no. If he starts bullying you, telling you it's part of your job, you still say no." "Not a problem," Steve had said. Harris ignored this. He had his speech, and he intended to stick to it. "Second, thou shalt not score drugs for him, not so much as a single joint. Third, thou shalt not score women for him. And he's apt to ask you, particularly if some good-looking babes show up at the receptions I'm setting up for him along the way. As with the booze and the drugs, if he scores on his own, that's one thing, but don't help him." Steve had thought of telling Harris that he wasn't a pimp, that Harris must have confused him with his own father, and decided that would be fairly imprudent. He opted for silence instead. "Fourth, thou shalt not cover up for him. If he starts boozing or drugging, particularly if you have reason to think he's doing coke again, get in touch with me at once. Do you understand? At once." "I understand," Steve replied, and he had, but that didn't mean he would necessarily comply. He had decided he wanted this gig in spite of the problems it presented, in part because of the problems it presented. Life without problems was a fairly uninteresting proposition, but that didn't mean he was going to sell his soul to keep it, especially not to a suit with a big gut and the voice of an overgrown kid who has spent too much of his adult life trying to get some payback for real or imagined slights he had suffered in the elementary school playground. And although John Merenville was a bit of an asshole, Steve didn't hold that against him. Harris, though, Harris was in a whole other league. Appleton had leaned forward at this point, making his lone contribution to the discussion before Merenville's agent could get to the final commandment. "What's your impression of Johnny?" he asked Steve. "He's 56 years old, you know, and he's put a lot of hard mileage on the original equipment, especially in the 80s. He wound up in the emergency room 3 different times, twice in Connecticut and once down here. The first 2 were drug ODs. I'm not telling tales out of school, because all that's been reported, exhaustively, in the press. The last one may have been a suicide attempt, and that is a tale out of school. I'd ask you to keep it to yourself." Steve had nodded. "So, what do you think?" Appleton asked. "Can he really drive almost 0.5 ton of motorcycle cross-country from Connecticut to California and do 20 or so readings and receptions along the way? I want to know what you think, Mr. Ames, because I'm frankly doubtful." He had expected Harris to come busting in then, touting the legendary strength and iron balls of his client. Steve knew suits, he knew agents, and Harris was both. But Harris was silent, just looking at him. Maybe he wasn't so stupid after all, Steve thought. Maybe he even cared a little for this particular client. You guys know him a lot better than I do, he said. Hell, I only met him for the first time 2 weeks ago, and I've never read one of his books. Harris's face said that last didn't surprise him at all. Precisely why I'm asking you, Appleton replied. We have known him for a long time. Me since 1985, when he used to party with the beautiful people at 54. Bill since 1965. He's the literary world's Jerry Garcia. That's unfair, Harris said stiffly. Appleton shrugged. New eyes see clear, my grandmother used to say. So tell me, Mr. Ames, do you think he can do it? Steve had seen the question was serious, maybe even vital, and thought it over for almost a full minute. The other two men sat and let him. Well, he had said at last, I don't know if he can just eat the cheese and stay away from the wine at the receptions, but make it across to California on the bike? Yeah, probably. He looks fairly strong. A lot better than Jerry Garcia did near the end, I'll tell you that. I've worked with a lot of rockers half his age who don't look as good. Appleton had looked dubious. Mostly, though, it's a look he gets on his face. He wants to do this. He wants to get out on the road, kick some ass, take down some names, and... Steve had found himself thinking of his favorite movie, one he watched on tape every year or so, Hombre, with Paul Newman and Richard Boone. He had smiled a little. And he looks like a man who's still got a lot of hard bark left on him. Ah. Appleton had looked downright mystified at that. Steve hadn't been much surprised. If Appleton had ever come equipped with hard bark, Steve thought it had probably all rubbed off by the time he was a sophomore at Exeter or Choate or wherever he'd gone to wear his blazers and rep ties. Harris had cleared his throat. If we've got that out of the way, the final commandment... Appleton groaned. Harris went on looking at Steve, pretending not to hear. The fifth and final commandment, he had repeated. Thou shalt not pick up hitchhikers in thy truck. Neither male nor female shalt thou pick them up, but especially not female. Which was probably why Steve Ames never hesitated when he saw the girl standing beside the road just outside Ely, the skinny girl with her nose bent and her hair dyed two different colors. He just pulled over and stopped. 2. She opened the door, but didn't get into the cab at first, just looked up at him from across the map-littered seat with wide blue eyes. Are you a nice person? She asked. Steve thought this over, then nodded. Yeah, I guess so, he said. I like a cigar 2 or 3 times a day, but I never kicked a dog that wasn't bigger than me, and I send money home to my mama once every 6 weeks. You're not going to try to slap the make on me or anything? Nope, Steve said, amused. He liked the way her wide blue eyes remained fixed on his face. She looked like a little kid studying the funny pages. I'm fairly well under control in that regard. And you're not like a crazy serial killer or anything? No, but Jesus Christ, do you think I'd tell you if I was? I'd probably see it in your eyes, the skinny girl with the two-tone hair told him. And although she sounded grave enough, she was smiling a little. I got a psychic streak. It ain't wide, but it's there, buddy. It's really, really there. A refrigerator truck roared past, the guy laying on his horn all the way by, even though Steve had squeezed over until the stubby rider was mostly on the shoulder, and the road itself was empty in both directions. No big surprise about that, though. In Steve's experience, some guys simply couldn't keep their hands off their horns or their dicks. They were always honking one or the other. Enough with the questionnaire, lady. Do you want to ride or not? I've got to roll my wheels. In truth, he was a lot closer to the boss than the boss would maybe approve of. Marinville liked the idea of being on his own in America. Mr. Free Bird, have pen, will travel. And Steve thought that was just how he'd write his book. That was fine, too. Great. Totally cool. But he, Stephen Andrew Ames of Lubbock, also had a job to do. His was to make sure Marinville didn't have to write the book on a Ouija board instead of his word processor. His view on how to accomplish that end was simplicity itself. Stay close and let no situation get out of hand unless it absolutely couldn't be helped. He was 70 miles back instead of 150, but what the boss didn't know wouldn't hurt him. "You'll do, I guess," she said, hopped up into the cab and slammed the door shut. "Well, thank you, Cookie," he said. "I'm touched by your trust." He checked the rearview mirror, saw nothing but the ass end of Ely, and got back out on the road again. "Don't call me that," she said. "It's sexist." "Cookie is sexist? Oh, please." In a prim little no-nonsense voice, she said, "Don't call me Cookie and I won't call you Cake." He burst out laughing. She probably wouldn't like it, but he couldn't help it. That was the way laughing was, sort of like farting. Sometimes you could hold it in, but a lot of times you couldn't. He glanced at her and saw that she was laughing a little too, and slipping her backpack off, so maybe that was all right. He put her at about 5'6" and skinny as a rail, 100 pounds max and probably more like 95. She was wearing a tank top with torn-off sleeves. It gave an awfully generous view of her breasts for a girl worried about meeting Ted Bundy in a rider van. Not that she had a lot to worry about up there. Steve guessed she could still shop in the training bra section at Walmart if she wanted to. On the front of the shirt, a black guy with dreadlocks grinned from the middle of a blue-green psychedelic sunburst. Bent around his head like a halo were the words, "Not gonna give it up." "You must like Peter Tosh," she said. "It can't be my tits."
"I worked with Peter Tosh once," he replied.
"No way."
"Way," he said.
He glanced in the rear view and saw that Ely was already gone. It was spooky how fast that happened out here. He supposed that if he were a young female hitchhiker, he might ask a question or two himself before hopping willy-nilly into someone's car or truck. It might not help, but it sure couldn't hurt. Because once you were out in the desert, anything could happen to you. "When did you work with Peter Tosh?"
1980 or 81, he said. "I can't remember which. Madison Square Garden, then in Forest Hills. Dylan played the encore with him at Forest Hills. Blowing in the Wind, if you can believe that."
She was looking at him with frank amazement, unmixed, so far as he could tell, with doubt.
"Whoa, cool. What were you, a roadie?"
"Then, yeah. Later on I was a guitar tech. Now I'm..." Yes, that was a good start, but just what was he now? Not a guitar tech, that was for sure. Sort of demoted to roadie again. Also part-time shrink. Also sort of like Mary Poppins, only with long brown hippie hair that was starting to show some gray along the center part.
"Now I'm into something else."
"What's your name?"
"Cynthia Smith," she said, and held out a hand.
He shook it. Her hand was long, feather-light inside of his, and incredibly fine-boned. It was a little like shaking hands with a bird.
"I'm Steve Ames."
"From Texas."
"Yeah, Lubbock. Guess you heard the accent before, huh?"
"Once or twice." Her gammon grin lit up her whole face. "You can take the boy out of Texas, but..." He joined her for the rest of it, and they grinned at each other, already friends. The way people can become friends for a little while, when they happen to meet on American back roads that go through the lonely places. 3. Cynthia Smith was clearly a flake, but Steve was a veteran flake himself. You couldn't spend most of your adult life in the music business without succumbing to flakedom, and it didn't bother him. She told him she had every reason to be careful of guys. One had nearly torn off her left ear, and another had broken her nose not so long ago. "And the one who did the ear was a guy I liked," she added. "I'm sensitive about the ear. The nose, I think the nose has character, but I'm sensitive about the ear. God knows why." He glanced across at her ear. "Well, it's a little flat on top, I guess, but so what? If you're really sensitive about it, you could grow your hair out and cover it up, you know." "Not happening," she said firmly, and fluffed her hair, leaning briefly to the right, so she could get a look at herself in the mirror mounted on her side of the cab. The half on Steve's side was green, the other half was orange. "My friend Gert says I look like Little Orphan Annie from Hell. That's too cool to change."
"Not gonna give them curls up, huh?"
She smiled, patted the front of her shirt,
and lapsed into a passable Jamaican imitation. I go my own way, just like Peter Mon. Cynthia Smith's way had been to leave home and her parents' more or less constant disapproval at the age of 17. She had spent a little time on the East Coast. I left when I realized I was getting to be a mercy fuck, she said matter-of-factly, and then had drifted back as far as the Midwest, where she had gotten sort of clean and met a good-looking guy at an AA meeting. The good-looking guy had claimed to be entirely clean, but he had lied. Oh, boy, had he lied. Cynthia had moved in with him just the same, a mistake. I've never been what you'd call bright about men, she told Steve in that same matter-of-fact voice. The good-looking guy had come home one night, fucked up on crystal meth, and had apparently decided he wanted Cynthia's left ear as a bookmark. She had gone to a shelter, gotten a little more than sort of clean, even worked as a counselor for a while after the woman in charge had been murdered and it looked as if the place might close. The guy who murdered Anna is the same guy who broke my nose, she said. He was bad. Richie, the guy who wanted my ear for a bookmark, he only had a bad temper. Norman was bad, as in crazy. They catch him? Cynthia solemnly shook her head. Anyway, we couldn't let DNS go under just because one guy went crazy when his wife left him, so we all pitched in to save it. We did, too. DNS? Stands for Daughters and Sisters. I got a lot of my confidence back while I was there. She was looking out the window at the passing desert and rubbing the ball of her thumb pensively along the bent bridge of her nose. In a way, even the guy who did this helped me with that. Norman. Yep. Norman Daniels, that was his name, at least me and Gert, she's my pal, the one who says I look like Orphan Annie, stood up to him, you know? Uh-huh. So, last month, I finally wrote home to my folks. I put my return address on the letter, too. I thought when they wrote back, if they ever did, they'd be righteously pissed, my dad especially. He used to be a minister. He's retired now, but you can take the boy out of the hellfire, but you can't take the hellfire out of the boy. Steve said. She smiled. Well, that's sort of what I expected, but the letter I got back was pretty neat. I called them. We talked. My dad cried. She said this with a touch of wonder. I mean, he cried. Can you believe that? Hey, I toured for 8 months with Black Sabbath, Steve said. I can believe anything. So you're going home, huh? Return of the prodigal cookie? She gave him a look. He gave her a grin. Sorry. Yeah, sure you are. Anyway, that's close. Where's home? Bakersfield. Which reminds me, how far are you going? San Francisco, but... She grinned. Are you kidding? That's so cool! But I can't promise to take you that far. In fact, I can't absolutely promise to take you any further than Austin. The one in Nevada, you know, not the one in Texas. I know where Austin is. I've got a map. She said, and now she was giving him a stupid big brother look that he liked even better than her wide-eyed Miss Prim gaze. She was a cutie, all right, and wouldn't she just love it if he told her that? I'll take you as far as I can, but this gig is a little weird. I mean, all gigs are kind of weird. Show business is weird by nature, and this is showbiz. I guess, anyway, but... I mean... He stopped. What did he mean, exactly? His span of employment as a writer's roadie, an ill-fitting title. You didn't have to be a writer yourself to know that, but the only one he could think of, was almost over, and he still didn't know what to think of it, or of Johnny Merenville himself. All he knew for sure was that the great man hadn't asked Steve to score him any dope or women, and that he'd never answered Steve's knock on his hotel room door with whiskey on his breath. For now, that was enough. He could think about how he was going to describe it on his resume later. "What is the gig?" she asked. "I mean, this doesn't look big enough to be a band truck. Are you touring with a folkie this time? Gordon Lightfoot? Someone like that?" Steve grinned. "My guy is sort of a folkie, I guess, only he plays his mouth instead of a guitar or a harmonica. He..." That was when the cellular phone on the dashboard gave out its strident, oddly nasal cry. Meep! Meep! Steve grabbed it off the dashboard, but didn't open it right away. He looked at the girl instead. "Don't say a word," he told her as the phone meeped in his hand a third time. "You might get me in trouble if you do, okay?" "Meep, meep." She nodded. Steve flipped the phone's mouthpiece open and then pushed send on the keypad, which was how you accepted an incoming call. The first thing he was aware of when he put the phone to his ear was how heavy the static was. He was amazed the call had gone through at all. "Hello? That's you, boss?" There was a deeper, smoother roar behind the static, the sound of a truck going by, Steve thought, and then Marinville's voice. Steve could hear panic even through the static, and it kicked his heart into a higher gear. He had heard people talking in that tone before. It happened at least once on every rock tour, it seemed. And he recognized it at once. At Johnny Marinville's end of the line, shit of some variety had hit the fan. "Steve! Steve! I'm... Ubble! Bad!" He stared out at the road, running straight arrow into the desert, and felt little seeds of sweat starting to form on his brow. He thought of the boss's tubby little agent with his thou shalt nots and his bullying voice, then swept all that away. The last person he needed cluttering up his head right now was Bill Harris. "Were you in an accident? Is that it? What's up, boss? Say again." Crackle, zit, crackle. "Johnny! Hear me?" "Yes, I hear you." Shouting into the phone now, knowing it was totally useless, but doing it anyway. Aware, out of the corner of his eye, that the girl was looking at him with mounting concern. "What's happened to you?" No answer for so long, he was positive this time that he had lost Marinville. He was taking the phone away from his ear when the boss's voice came through again, impossibly far off, like a voice coming in from another galaxy. "West. Ely. Iffy." No, not iffy, Steve thought. Not iffy, but 50. "I'm west of Ely on Highway 50. Maybe, anyway. Maybe that's what he's saying. Accident. Got to be. He drove his scoot off the road, and he's sitting out there with a bust leg and blood maybe pouring down his face. And when I get back to New York, his guys are going to crucify me, if for no other reason than that they can't crucify him. Not sure how far, least, probably more. RV pulled off the road. It'll farther up." The heaviest blast of static yet, then something about cops. State cops and town cops. "What's?" the girl in the passenger seat began. "Shh, not now." From the phone. "My bike. Into the desert. Wind. A mile or so east of the RV." And that was all. Steve yelled Johnny's name into the phone half a dozen times, but only silence came back. The connection had been broken. He used the name/menu button to bring up JM in the display window, then pushed send. A recorded voice welcomed him to the Western Roaming Network. There was a pause, and then another recording told him that his call could not be completed at this time. The voice began to list all the reasons why this might be so. Steve pushed end and flipped the phone closed. "God damn it!" "It's bad, isn't it?" Cynthia asked. Her eyes were very wide again, but there was nothing cute about them now. "I can see it in your face." "Maybe," he said, then shook his head, impatient with himself. "Probably. That was my boss. He's up the line somewhere. 70 miles would be my best guess, but it might be as much as 100. He's riding a Harley. He..." "Big red and cream bike?" she asked, suddenly excited. "Does he have long gray hair, sort of like Jerry Garcia's?" He nodded. "I saw him this morning, way far east of here," she said. "He filled up at this little gas station cafeteria place in Pretty Nice. You know that town, Pretty Nice?" He nodded. "I was eating breakfast and saw him out the window. I thought he looked familiar, like I'd seen him on Oprah, or maybe Ricky Lake." "He's a writer." Steve looked at the speedometer, saw he had the panel truck up to 70, and decided he can let it out just a little more. The needle crept toward 75. Outside the windows, the desert ran backward a little faster. He's crossing the country, getting material for a book. He's done some speaking, too, but mostly he just goes places and talks to people and makes notes. Anyway, he's had an accident. At least I think that's what happened. The connection was fucked, wasn't it? Uh-huh. Do you want to pull over? Let me out? Because it's no problem, if that's what you want. He thought it over carefully. Now that the initial shock was receding, his mind seemed to be ticking away coldly and precisely, as it always had before in situations like this. No, he decided. He didn't want her out, not at all. He had a situation on his hands, one that had to be dealt with right away, but that didn't mean the future could be forgotten. Appleton might be okay, even if Johnny Merrinville had high-sided his Harley and fucked himself up big time. He had looked like the sort of man who could, blazers and repties notwithstanding, accept the idea that sometimes things went wrong. Bill Harris, however, had struck Steve as a man who believed in pin the blame on the donkey when things went wrong, and jamming that pin as far up the donkey's ass as it would go. As the potential donkey, Steve decided what he would really like was a witness, one who had never set eyes on him before today. No, I'd like you to ride along, but I have to be straight with you. I don't know what we're going to find. There could be blood. I can deal with blood, she said. 4. She made no comment about how fast he was going, but when the rental truck hit 85 and the frame began to shake, she fastened her shoulder harness. Steve squeezed the gas pedal a little harder, and when the truck got up around 90, the vibration eased. He kept both hands curled around the wheel, though. The wind was kicking up, and at these speeds, a good hard gust could swerve you onto the shoulder. Then, if your tire sank in, you were in real trouble, flipping over trouble. The boss would have been even more vulnerable to wind shear on his bike, Steve reflected. Maybe that was what had happened. By now, he had told Cynthia the basic facts of his employ. He made reservations, checked routes, vetted sound systems at the places where the boss was scheduled to speak, stayed out of the way so as not to conflict with the picture the boss was painting. Johnny Merrinville, the thinking man's lone wolf, a politically correct Sam Peckinpah hero, a writer who hadn't forgotten how to hang tough and lay cool. The panel truck, Steve told her, was empty, except for some extra gear and a long wooden ramp, which Johnny could ride up if the weather got too foul to cycle in. Since this was midsummer, that wasn't very likely, but there was another reason for the ramp as well, and for the tie-down Steve had installed on the floor of the van before setting out. This one was unspoken by either of them, but both had known it was there from the day they had set out from Westport, Connecticut. Johnny Merrinville might wake up one morning and simply find himself unwilling to keep riding the Harley. Or incapable of it. I've heard of him, Cynthia said, but I never read anything by him. I like Dean Koontz and Danielle Steele, mostly. I just read for pleasure. Nice bike, though, and the guy had great hair. Rock and roll hair, you know? Steve nodded. He knew. Merrinville did, too. You really worried about him, or just worried about what might happen to you? He likely would have resented the question if someone else had asked it, but he sensed no implied criticism in Cynthia's tone, only curiosity. I'm worried about both, he said. She nodded. How far have we come? He glanced down at the odometer. 45 miles since I lost him off the phone. But you don't know exactly where he was calling from. No. You think he just fucked himself up, or someone else, too? He looked over at her, surprised. That the boss might have fucked someone else up was exactly what he was afraid of, but he never would have said so out loud if she hadn't raised the possibility first. Somebody else might be involved, he had replied reluctantly. He said something about state cops and town cops. It might have been, don't call the state cops, call the town cops. I couldn't tell for sure.
She pointed to his cellular, which was back on the dashboard.
No way, he said. I'm not calling any cops until I see what kind of mess he's gotten himself into.
And I promise that won't be in my statement if you promise not to call me Cookie anymore.
He smiled a little.